You are now listening to Jess's Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jess's Lit. We are back with another episode of the Sonnet series. Today, we'll be starting off of Sonnet 83, and then we'll do some analysis, some close reading, and just experimentation with the forms and all of the inner meanings of Shakespeare's wondrous poems. I hope everyone's doing pretty well. The weather has gotten kind of gloomy lately, but still no rain. It did rain a little bit last night, but I kind of felt good about the rain, because we haven't gotten rain in a while, and so we are expected to get some rain for the past few days. And so, that's something new. Pretty packed day with the sonnets. I do have a couple songs that I have played in the previous episodes, but I just love them so much, and so I'll play some before we go on to the sonnets. And that's basically it for today. We have some ads, show promos, and PSAs, followed up with Katie Lang's Constant Craving, and we'll be right back after this.
Hello. Take a moment to ease your mind. I'm glad you're here. Have you been to that sacred place within? That place that sound can create? Let's go there together. A place with the freshest beats. Gamelan tones of Indonesia. The many sounds of Brazil. The possibilities are infinite. All available on Mixitroph, the best in world music, every other Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m. Join me, Nolzy, for exclusive interviews with local musicians and musical explorations. Tune in!
Beautiful day.
Yeah.
Are you hungry? I think I'm hungry. I think we should get ourselves something nice for our beach day.
Oh yeah?
Oh my god, I know the perfect place. Cockney King's Fish and Chips is literally just around the corner. We should go there. It is the best fish and chips in Vancouver.
Oh my god, yes, absolutely. Let's go right now.
Cockney King's Fish and Chips, Kitsilano. On Cornwall Avenue, between Cypress and Walnut. It's the best fish and chips in town, but don't take our word for it. Try it yourself. If Kitsilano isn't your neighborhood, check out Cockney King's in Burnaby or New Westminster.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's R-I-D-E-O-N Bike Shop. See you there.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
We are back. That was Katie Lang's Constant Craving and some ads, show promos, and PSAs. We'll get right into Sonnet 83. I never saw that you did painting need, and therefore to your fair no painting set. I found, or thought I found, you did exceed the barren tender of a poet's debt. And therefore have I slept in your report that you yourself being extent, while might slow show, how far a modern quill doth come too short, speaking of worth, what worth in your doth grow? This silence for my sin you did impute, which shall be most my glory being dumb. For I impair not beauty being mute, when others would give life and bring a tomb. Their lives more life in one of your fair eyes, than both your poets can in praise devise. Now here we see that the sonnet continues from the previous, Sonnet 82. But the poet has learned to his dismay that his plain speaking or his silence has offended the beloved. And he argues that no words can match the beloved's beauty. With lines 1 and 2, the speaker opens by claiming he has never thought, the beloved needed a painting that is quoted, and the painting is a metaphor for poetic embellishment or artificial praise. And since the beloved's beauty is already complete and natural, the speaker is refraining from adoring it with poetic paint. Again, we're given a lot of reference to paint here, and in this case, paint refers to flattery or verse. And implicitly, this positions the speaker as honest and sincere, unlike other poets who might use overly decorative language. With lines 3 and 4, here the speaker says he believed the youth's worth surpassed what a poet could repay or express. And the phrase barren tender suggests that poetic praise is ultimately insufficient. We could see that in the word barren as a form of tribute, and we could see that in the word tender. We could see that the line is both humble, how it admits to poetic inadequacy, and flattering at the same time, which elevates the beloved's beyond verbal expression. With lines 5 and 6, now here, because the beloved's presence alone is enough, the speaker has, quote-unquote, slept in your report, which basically means remain silent or inactive in praising him. The phrase being extant, which means being alive or present, the youth can now show his own worth without needing a poet to speak for him. Line 7 and 8, the speaker critiques contemporary poets, and we could see that in the phrase modern quill, and this suggests they fall short when trying to capture the youth's worth. And again, this flatters the beloved by asserting that his excellence is beyond even the most skilled poetic expression. With lines 9 and 10, the youth has accused the speaker of wrongdoing, sin in this case, for remaining silent. And so because of him remaining silent, the youth has accused the speaker of a sin. But the speaker turns this around, and his dumbness, which implies silence, becomes a kind of glory or virtue. And so we see a kind of a turnaround here. And this rhetorical move justifies an action as a higher form of praise. And so by not speaking, the speaker ultimately avoids diminishing beauty. With lines 11 to 12, here the speaker argues that by being silent, he avoids, quote-unquote, impairing the youth's beauty. And in contrast, others who try to give life through poetry end up metaphorically building a, quote-unquote, tomb, where they fossilize or distort true beauty by trying to describe it. There's a paradox as well, where we could see that the poetic life, or their poetic life, is actually a kind of death, in a sense. Lines 13 to 14, the final couplet. Now, we are provided with a final stroke, where the beloved single eye holds more life, like energy, beauty, and presence than all the poetic efforts of others combined. And also the phrase, both your poets, may refer to rival poets who have praised the youth and whose efforts fall short. And that was Sonnet 83. Moving on to Sonnet 84, we'll give this one a read. Who is it that says most, which can say more than this rich praise that you alone are you, in whose confine immured is the store, which should example where your equal grew, lean penury within that pen doth dwell, that to his subject lends not some small glory, but he that writes of you, if he can tell that you are you, so dignifies his story. Let him but copy what in you is writ, not making worse what nature made so clear, and such a counterpart shall fame his wit, making his style admired everywhere. You, to your beauteous blessings add a curse, being fonder praise, which makes your praises worse. Now, with Sonnet 84, the poet reiterates his claim that poems praising the beloved should reflect the beloved's perfections rather than exaggerate them. And we can see that he accuses the beloved of caring too much for praise. With lines 1 and 2, the speaker begins with a question, a rhetorical question, of who can offer greater praise than simply acknowledging that you are yourself? Now we're going kind of deep philosophical sense. And the phrase you alone are you implies implies an ineffable uniqueness, where there is no comparison, no equal, and no standard beyond the beloved's own being. And the superlative rich praise is paradoxically minimalist, where the idea is that the truest compliment is not embellished language, but the bare assertion of just identity alone. With lines 3 and 4, the metaphor here shifts to one of containment. The store, the quote-unquote store, which implies a treasury of value, is quote-unquote immured, which means walled in or imprisoned, and that is within the beloved. And so this suggests that the full measure of worth that could inspire or educate others is trapped within the beloved's singular form. The hypothetical clause, the phrase which should example where your equal grew, proposes that if there were others like the beloved, this internal store might serve as an example for them. But, however, since there is no equal, the value will remain internal, enclosed, and unreplicated. With lines 5 and 6, here the pen, the reference to the pen, is both the literal writer's tool and also a symbolic extension of poetic effort. The poet who does not enhance his subject with, quote-unquote, some small glory, suffers from, quote-unquote, lean penury, which is a poverty of imagination or expression. And so these two lines, in a sense, critique is a criticism of weak poets who fail to elevate their subject through their verse. With lines 7 and 8, we return to the earlier idea where the speaker says that merely stating you are you dignifies the poet's work, and so no embellishment is needed beyond the faithful recording of this rare identity. And ultimately, the beauty lies in accurate recognition, not hyperbole. With lines 9 to 10, now we are calling for a mimesis. So let the poet merely copy what is already perfectly inscribed by nature in the beloved. And so this kind of gets us thinking, but in order to realize or kind of comprehend what's going on here, For those of you guys who don't really know what a mimesis is, it's basically a representation or an imitation of the real world in art or literature. And so the poet is, so we're allowing the poet to merely copy what is already perfectly inscribed by nature in the beloved. So we're getting a lot of references and comparisons with nature, beauty, and the human nature as well. And so the clarity of the beloved's virtues, which is established by nature, needs no poetic distortion or invention, only a faithful transcription. And so this is worth kind of thinking about. With lines 11 to 12, if the poet simply mirrors the beloved's natural excellence, the resulting quote-unquote counterpart, which is implied the poem, will bring faith to his wit. So wit meaning intellect and style. And we see that his reputation will flourish not from invention, but from accurate reflection. And so we can see here that we could see an irony here. And the irony is that the humility in poetic voice leads to the greatest acclaim. The final couplet here kind of offers a twist where the beloved, despite possessing these quote-unquote beauteous blessings, mars them with vanity and is being fawned on praise. Now, this love of being praised, ironically, in a sense, undermines the praise itself, and the implication is that the subject's desire for flattery corrupts the sincerity and dignity of the praise they receive. That was Sonnet 84. We'll move on to Sonnet 85. My tongue-tied muse in manners holds her still, while comments of her praise richly compiled reserve their character with golden quill and precious phrase by all the muses filed. I think good thoughts whilst other write good works, and like unlettered clerks still cry amen to every hymn that able spirits affords in polished form of well-refined pen. Hearing you praised, I say 'tis so, 'tis true, and to the most of praise add something more. But that is in my thought, whose love to you, though words come hindmost, holds his rank before. Then others for the breath of words respect, me for my dumb thoughts speaking in effect. Now, in this first or two linked sonnets, we see that the poet says that his silence, in the face of others, extravagant praise of the beloved is only outward muteness. And so his thoughts are filled, are ultimately filled with love. We'll analyze lines 1 to 4. Now, the phrase, my tongue-tied muse, that's significant because the speaker opens by acknowledging their own poetic inadequacy. Their muse, which is implied the source of inspiration, is quote-unquote tongue-tied. And that's we can see that it's a vivid metaphor for inarticulateness or self-restraint. The phrase, in matters holds her still, this suggests not only inability, but decorum, perhaps humility or reverence, has silenced the speaker. And meanwhile, the quote-unquote comments of your praise, which is praises of the beloved, are richly compiled by others, described with elevated diction, such as the golden quill or the precious phrase, and that these poets are imagined as officially submitting their tributes to a sort of divine archive. We could see that in the phrase, by all the muses filled. With lines 5 and 8, here a contrast is drawn where the speaker thinks good thoughts while others write good words. Now it's a tension between interior truth and the external expression. The comparison to an unlettered clerk kind of reinforces the speaker's sense of inferiority, which is a religious scribe who can't write, only say amen to others' spiritual eloquence. The words "heim" and "spirit" invoke religious language. And the phrase "polished form of well-refined pen" ultimately reflects the speaker's admiration for the other's stylistic finesse, while also perhaps subtly suggesting over-refinement. With lines 9 to 12, the speaker consents to others' praise in the phrases "tis so" and "tis true," but claims to add something more, not with words, but mentally. The phrase "this is in my thought," that phrase is significant because we could see that the speaker's love is silent, perhaps more sincere for being unspoken. And in line 12, we are pivoting on a paradox. In the phrase, "though words come hindmost, my love holds his rank before." And so hindmost suggests tardiness or inferiority in expression, but love, quote-unquote, holds his rank before. And so that in priority or nobility, suggesting true value lies in thought and feeling, not rhetoric. The final couplet is a kind of a contrast as well, where we are offered wit and admiration for their breadth of words, and however, the speaker speaks or seeks to be valued for their dumb thoughts, which is silent, inarticulate love that nevertheless speaks in effect. And this phrase clearly inverts expectations, where speechless thoughts still communicate, and they are effective in feeling, if not in language. Moving on to sonnets 86. "Was it the proud full sail of his great verse, bound for the prize of all too precious you, that did my ripe thoughts in my brain inhearse, making thereto the womb wherein they grow? Was it his spirit by spirits taught to write above a mortal pitch that struck me dead? No, neither he nor his compeers by night given him aid my verse astonished. He nor that effable familiar voice, which nightly gulls him with intelligence, as victors of my silence cannot boast, I was not sick of any fear from thence. But when your countenance filled up his line, then lacked I matter that enfeebled mine." Now, it's a rival poet. It's referring to the rival poet, and that sonnet continues from sonnet 685, but in a sense kind of echoes the imagery of sonnet 80, where the poet explains that his silence is not from fear of his rival, but results from having nothing to write about, now that the rival's verse has appropriated the beloved's favor. With lines 1 and 2, the speaker opens with a rhetorical question. The proud full sail of his great verse is a metaphor likening the rival's poetry to a ship sailing gloriously forward, and is seen as ambitious and also perhaps even arrogant at times. The phrase "bound for the prizes of all too precious you" makes clear that the destination of the object of poetic pursuit is the youth referred to as you, who is all too precious. And this emphasizes both the beloved's value and possibility. It kind of emphasizes both the beloved's value and possibly a sense of over-idealization. With lines 3 and 4, the phrase "inhearse" is striking because it means to entomb or inter. And so in this case, entombing his quote-unquote ripe thoughts in his own brain. The paradox of the tomb being the womb is also kind of complex and significant, as it kind of implies that his ideas are both dead and gestating, and creativity is simultaneously stifled and internalized at the same time. with lines 5 and 6. Now here, his spirit suggests the rival's inspiration or poetic soul, and by spirits taught, this implies divine or supernatural guidance, perhaps invoking the idea of a muse or some sort of ghostly inspiration. The phrase above a mortal pitch indicates a level of excellence beyond human, which again elevates the rival. And the phrase struck me dead, that's a metaphorical phrase, which kind of implies that if rendered speechless, creatively inert and overwhelmed. Now with lines 7 and 8, here the poet decisively rejects those earlier ideas. And the phrase compares by night could mean fellow poets, muses, or even supernatural beings aiding the rival in his nightly composition. My verse astonished. That phrase means stunned or rendered ineffective. But he now insists they weren't the cause of that. With lines 9 and 10, the effable familiar ghost, this phrase is likely a reference to a muse or spirit. And the phrase gulls him with intelligence means deceives or tricks him with supposed insight or poetic inspiration. With lines 11 to 12, these lines kind of clarify the rival and his aides and kind of explains how they have not defeated the speaker, and his silence is not a result of fear or awe of them. And the phrase sick of any fear means overcome or paralyzed by fear, which he ultimately denies. The final couplet, we are presented with the volta, and we realize that the real reason for his poetic silence is because of, it kind of comes in when the youth's beauty or presence begin to appear in the rival's verse. And so because of this, the speaker was left without matter, which implies subject matter. And the phrase that enfeebled mine, this kind of implies that his own poetry was weakened because the beloved had already been perfectly captured by someone else's verse. And so that was Sonnet 86. Before we move on to Sonnet 87, we will play another song, and this one is called Think on Me by Portia White. So we'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
That was Think on Me by Portia White, Sonnet 87. Farewell, thou art too dear for my possessing, and like enough thou knowest thy estimate. The charter of thy worth gives thee releasing. My bonds in thee are all determinate. For how do I hold thee but by thy granting, and for that riches where is my deserving? The cause of this fair gift in me is wanting, and so my patent black again is swerving. Thyself thou gavest my own worth the not knowing, or me to whom thou gavest else mistaking. So thy great gift upon this prison growing, comes home again on better judgment making. Thus have I had thee as a dream both flatter, in sleep a king, but waking no such matter. Now here the poet writes as if his relationship with the beloved has ended, and as if that relationship had been a wonderful dream from which he has now waked. With lines 1 to 4, the speaker kind of opens with a farewell, signaling loss or separation. And the charter of thy worth functions as a legal metaphor, a kind of contract or document that proves the beloved's intrinsic value. And this legal financial language suggests a transactional quality to the relationship now coming to an end. Lines 5 and 8, the speaker recognizes that any hold they had on the beloved was only by permission, not by merit. And the fair gift is the beloved's love or presence. And the speaker admits that there is no cause or justification in themselves to have received it. With lines 9 to 12, we see that here the speaker explains the relationship retrospectively. The beloved gave themselves in ignorance, either not knowing their own worth or misjudging the speaker's. And so this kind of tinges with regret, suggesting that the love was based on a mistaken understanding. The phrase misprison means misunderstanding or mistake, and the speaker says that the beloved's love was founded on a mistaken premise and is now, with better judgment, the beloved wants to take the love back. Or he ultimately does take the love back. Or the beloved does. The final couplet, we are presented with a metaphor. The entire relationship was like a dream, which was flattering and grand, but ultimately insubstantial. And so the speaker compares themselves to a king in sleep, only to awaken to find the fantasy gone. And so we are given a contrast between dream and waking, and that contrast kind of, in a sense, encapsulates the theme of disillusionment. Sonnet 88. When thou shalt be disposed to set me light, and place my merit in the eye of scorn, upon thy side against myself I'll fight, and prove thee virtuous, though thou art forsworn. With mine own weakness being best acquainted, upon thy part I can set down a story, of faults concealed wherein I am attained, that thou in losing me shall win much glory. And I by this will be a gainer too, for bending all my loving thoughts on thee, the injuries that to myself I do, doing thee vantage double vantage me. Such is my love to thee I so belong, that for thy right myself will bear all wrong. So here the poet has been repudiated by the beloved, and the poet offers to sacrifice himself and his reputation in order to make the now estranged beloved look better. With lines 1 and 4, we see that the speaker imagines a future moment when the beloved might no longer value him, and also may publicly scorn or belittle his worth. We see that there's a tone of anticipatory resignation here, an exception that love might not be permanent. Now, in a paradoxical reversal, the speaker vows to take the beloved's side, even if he's betrayed, which is seen in the word forsworn, and defend him. And he commits to self-betrayal out of love, And this kind of signals an extreme self-sacrificial love, even at the own cost of truth or justice. With lines 5 to 8, the speaker acknowledges his own flaws and suggests an intimate self-awareness. And so he can therefore construct a narrative that frames the beloved in a good light, even if it means falsely highlighting his own faults. And he will reveal hidden faults of his own, perhaps exaggerating them to make the beloved's rejection seem justified or even noble. And so we see a very strange logic here. The beloved gains glory by casting off the speaker, but only because the speaker engineers that perception through a self-damning narrative. With lines 9 to 12, despite apparent loss, the speaker insists that he too will gain from this arrangement by channeling all his love toward the beloved. And so his emotional allegiance remains intact, and this internal consistency or constancy is for him a kind of victory. Now, for lines 11 to 12, we are presented with a paradox where hurting himself benefits the beloved, and because the beloved is all he loves, helping him, even at personal cost, is doubly rewarding. And so this, we can see love as a zero-sum game in which love is strangely transformed into gain. And there's also a theological flavor here where we could see a martyrdom of love. The final couplet is kind of a summing up of the entire sonnet in a declaration where his love is absolute, self-denying, and self-abnegating. And so that was the sonnet 88. Moving on to sonnet 89. Say that thou didst forsake me for some fault, and I will comment upon that offense. Speak of my lameness, and I straight will halt, against thy reasons making no defense. Thou canst not, love, disgrace me half so ill, to set a form upon desired change, as I'll myself disgrace, knowing thy will, I will acquaintance strangle and look strange. Be absent from thy walks, and in my tongue thy sweet beloved name no more shall dwell, lest I too much profane should do it wrong, and haply of our old acquaintance tell. For thee against myself I'll vow debate, for I must never love him whom thou dost hate. The sonnet is a extension of the closing line of sonnet 88, and the poet here lists the ways he will make himself look bad in order to make the beloved look good. With lines 1 and 2, the speaker opens with conditional language, like the phrase, say that, comment upon that offense, those words, and kind of sets up, well, the phrase comment upon that offense implies not only acceptance, but even an amplification of his own guilt. And so the tone is very self-effacing and submissive, suggesting intense devotion, or perhaps even self-erasure. With lines 3 and 4, the speaker dramatizes his willingness to mirror whatever criticisms the beloved offers, and if the beloved says he is lame, perhaps literally or metaphorically flawed, the speaker says he will immediately halt. The alliteration of speak, or the word straight and halt, emphasizes the immediacy and humility of his response. With lines 5 and 6, we see a shift where the speaker asserts that the beloved cannot shame him more than he is willing to shame himself. The phrase, to set a form upon desired change, suggests that the beloved's outward reason for separation is merely a pretense for an inward desire to change lovers. And the speaker recognizes this but refuses to resist. And we see an edge of sorrowful clarity here as well, where he knows that he is being rejected. Lines 7 and 8. Here, the speaker now vows to actively assist in the erasure of their relationship. He will disgrace himself, even sever ties with mutual friends, and that's seen in the phrase acquaintance, strangle, and adopt coldness as well, in the phrase look strange. And the violent metaphors here, in a sense, underscores the extremity of his emotional compliance. And so knowing thy will, this phrase shows he is motivated by, not by conviction, but by the beloved's desire. With lines 9 to 10, the speaker promises physical and verbal erasure, and that he will avoid the places the beloved frequents, and exile their name from his speech. The last couplet is now given reason. The speaker gives reason for his silence. This was lines 11 to 12. The speaker gives the reason for his silence, which is not out of anger, but reverence. The final couplet kind of, again, solidifies the poem's logic in a painful way. Because the poem's a bit painful, I guess it would be kind of solidifying the painful logic of the poem, and where he is so devoted that he will take arms against himself, which means fights his own heart, because the beloved has come to hate him. And so the phrase vow debate suggests internal conflict and a binding struggle between love and loyalty. And his love is so absolute, it obeys even objection or rejection. That is it for today. I don't think we're gonna have time to go over and analyze Sonnet 90, but I will read Sonnet 90 for you guys to kind of think about it until we close read it together. So it goes like this. Then hate me when thou wilt, if ever now. Now while the world is bent my deeds to cross, join with the spite of fortune, make me bow, and do not drop in for an after loss. Do not, when my heart hath scraped his sorrow, come in the rearward of a conquered woe. Give not a windy night a rainy morrow to linger out a purposed overthrow. If thou wilt leave me, do not leave me last, when other petty griefs have done their spite, but in the onset come, so shall I taste at first the very worst of fortune's might, and other strains of woe, which now seem woe, compared with loss of thee, will not seem so. And so that is Sonnet 90. Kind of think about it, and then we will come back next week with another close reading of this. But other than that, that is it for today's episode. We kind of went over sonnets 86, sonnet 83 to 89, and sonnet 90. You guys can kind of think about that until we close read it next week. But that is it. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your week. I will see you guys again on Wednesday next week at 11 a.m. Thank you all for joining, and have yourselves a great rest of your day and week. Thank you all. Bye-bye.